Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei describes the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps as the world's biggest anti-terror organization, warning of enemy plots to distort its image. Iran and Saudi Arabia say they are willing to open a new chapter in bilateral relations to help enhance security and stability of the region. And Palestinians bid farewell to the latest victim of Israeli atrocities after a deadly raid by the regime forces into the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. This is news. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the enemy is seeking to tarnish the image of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and the besieged volunteer force. Ayatollah Sayyed Ali Khamenei said the reasons behind the plot against the IRGC and besieged are their attractiveness that makes the enemy worried and agitated. The leader added that the enemy tries to smear the IRGC by resorting to fake news and rumors, as well as different kinds of deception and ploys. Ayatollah Khamenei underlined that the enemy would not like the IRGC to become a role model. The leader described the IRGC as the biggest anti-terrorist organization in the world. He praised the IRGC as a well-equipped, efficient, and independent military body, which has not stopped its work since its establishment around 4 decades ago. The leader made the comments in a meeting with the IRGC commanders. Tehran reiterates its readiness to cooperate with Riyadh in a wide array of issues, including regional security. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said both countries agree that previous deals regarding security, commerce, and economy must be implemented. Amir Abdollahian was speaking at a joint press conference with his Saudi counterpart. Prince Faisal bin Farhan said that Riyadh is looking forward to further strengthening relations on the basis of mutual respect. The Saudi Foreign Minister said Riyadh was willing to ensure lasting security in the region through cooperation with Tehran. He said King Salman has officially invited Iran's president to Riyadh. Prince Faisal made a visit to the Islamic Republic in June, just weeks after Tehran and Riyadh agreed to resume diplomatic relations. Two countries severed ties in 2016 following angry protests in Iran over the execution of Shia cleric Nimr al-Nimr in the kingdom. Iran and Saudi Arabia have pledged for enhanced regional stability. Fuad Zaidi says only time will tell whether Saudi Arabia can withstand pressure from the U.S. and Israel and maintain good relations with Iran.
I think the Saudi government has realized that confronting Iran is not in line with their national interest. It's really not possible to fight Iran in that manner any longer. And Iran historically has been interested in resolving issues with Saudi Arabia. Iran and Saudi Arabia are neighbors. Neighbors should not be confronted with each other. So I think as time passes, you will see these type of exchanges. I think with the visit of Iran's president, the ties will improve. There is a question that needs to be answered. That is whether the Saudis can withstand pressures from the United States and Israel to continue this policy of following their own interests instead of listening to the ill-advised rhetoric of the United States and Israel. Whether they can do that or not, time will tell, but I think so far, so good.
Iran has organized a conference in Tehran to review the effects of sanctions on the access of patients to life-saving medicines. Iranian officials have contradicted U.S. claims, asserting that medical supplies and food items have not been exempted from the sanctions in practice. Saman Khujuri reports.
Tehran has hosted a conference to discuss the effects of sanctions on the health of patients. Speaking at the event, Secretary of the Strategic Council of Foreign Relations Abbas Araghchi rejected the U.S. claims that medicine and food items are exempted from sanctions.
There might be such a thing on the surface, but in practice, the actions taken by the U.S. administration have imposed a strong sanction in this area. The U.S. sanctions against Iran cover a very wide network, and in addition to the humanitarian exceptions that they have apparently placed in the field of medicine, there are very detailed conditions by the Office of Foreign Assets Control of the U.S. Treasury Department in a way that makes their implementation practically impossible for pharmaceutical companies.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening the international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has led to a disruption in the accessibility of vital medical supplies for Iranian patients.
The most important report in this matter was submitted to the U.N. Human Rights Council last year by Mrs. Duhan, the special rapporteur on unilateral coercive measures of the United Nations. The U.S. and the West, self-proclaimed advocates of human rights, were against this reporter and even voted against the resolution to extend her mission. Even during her report presentation in September last year, they chose not to be present in the meeting hall. Self-criticism is not within their tolerance.
Although the U.S. claims that the sanctions do not directly ban the sales of medicines to Iran, they block every financial route needed to obtain drugs for patients suffering from diseases such as diabetes, kidney failure, hemophilia, multiple sclerosis, thalassemia, and leukemia. Iranian officials have repeatedly condemned the sanctions against the Iranian nation as a crime against humanity, saying such unilateral restrictive measures have put the lives of vulnerable people at risk by hampering their access to medicine. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Palestinians have held a funeral procession for the victim of the latest Israeli attack on the occupied West Bank. 32-year-old Mustafa Kastoni was fatally shot during a pre-dawn Israeli raid in the city of Jenin. The victim was a member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, an armed wing of President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah movement. The attack also left several people injured, including a female staff of the Palestinian Health Ministry. The assault came a day after the regime's troops raided the flashpoint city of Nablus, injuring dozens of Palestinians. The Israeli violence against Palestinians has been on the rise, with more and more Palestinians falling victim to Tel Aviv's brutalities day by day. At least 210 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied territories so far this year. On to Turkey. A stark division has emerged among those who express unwavering trust in the government's economic strategies and those who remain skeptical, seeing no signs of a positive outcome. That is, the Turkish president has vowed to ease the cost of living burden on the people as soon as possible.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has vowed to address the pressing cost of living crisis plaguing the nation. Attributing the situation to the global economic downturn, Erdogan has assured that his government will swiftly resolve this issue while upholding his promises to the people impacted by the devastating February earthquake. He had previously pledged to complete the reconstruction efforts within a year.
We vow to tackle the escalating cost of living caused by global crisis. We are aware that the cost of living has been suffocating our nation recently. As we have solved every problem of our country, I hope we will solve this problem again. We will not neglect anyone's right and will not leave anyone's expectations unanswered.
Analysts argue that this whole economic crisis is the result of wrong economic strategies and decisions made by the same ruling government for the past years, and they cannot fix what they have done now.
The people who created the problem and don't see it as a problem are very unlikely to fix it. For this reason, it's a naive to expect from the creator of the problem to solve the problem. I don't know on what basis the president is making these promises. He spoke about the cost of living, which has been getting higher for the past 2 years. Every month, we have a new raises in prices from foodstuff to rents and fuel. When the new government came and Mehmet Şimşek was appointed, we waited for something positive to happen. But the lira value against US dollar is dropping, and we are not seeing any new investments in the country. So where are all the new policies they want implement?
A few weeks ago, the vice president said that a new economic plan is to be revealed in September that will have a positive impact on the life of citizens, production and market, saying this plan will increase investments in the country.
Turkey, after the pandemic, was facing a few economic issues, just like other countries in the world, struggling to encounter post-lockdown repercussions, and then came the devastating earthquake, and then elections. So what we are facing, from inflation to change in lira value, is normal to what country has been going through. However, I think the government's plan will ease the economic crisis. But it will take time, of course. When speaking about the economy, nothing can happen in one night.
This is while inflation is gaining a new momentum. The annual inflation went up from 38.2% to 47.8% in a single month in July. Lack of economic investments, inflation, low Turkish lira value against the US dollar, and high cost of living. This is how the Turkish economy is going nowadays, with some blaming the pandemic and earthquake, while others say it is the government's wrong economic decisions. Amid the government promises and opposition criticism regarding Erdogan's extended tenure, there remains uncertainty regarding the potential success of the newly appointed economic team in swiftly executing their plans.
It's not that bad. Yes, the Turkish lira value has dropped and the cost of living has risen, but the government also raised the minimum wage and is trying to solve the economic problems which occurred due to the earthquake.
The ruling party must act fast to solve this economic crisis ahead of an upcoming critical local election, which will determine the fate of Istanbul, Ankara, and other major cities. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Armenia and Azerbaijan have traded blame for the situation in the Nagorno-Karabakh region during an emergency UN Security Council meeting.
These humanitarian issues clearly need to be resolved with the international community's strong intervention, before the negative consequences result in ethnic cleansing of the people of Nagorno-Karabakh.
I shall start by categorically rejecting all the unfounded and groundless allegations on blockade or humanitarian crisis propagated by Armenia against my country.
The 15-member council met as an Azerbaijani blockade of the disputed territory drags into its ninth month. Recently, a former International Criminal Court prosecutor said the blockade may amount to, quote, genocide of the local Armenian population. Meanwhile, a senior UN aid official told the council that the International Committee of the Red Cross must be allowed to resume the delivery of humanitarian relief to Nagorno-Karabakh.
The ICRC is doing everything it can, but as a single organization, it can only cover the most urgent needs. Other impartial humanitarian relief must also be allowed to reach civilians who need it, and a sustainable solution for safe and regular transit of people and goods must be found.
Other Security Council members also addressed the session. Russia said that it will use all diplomatic channels to prevent a humanitarian tragedy, as well as resuming the provision of essential goods to the region. The U.S. called on both sides to meet their obligations under international humanitarian law, while urging Azerbaijan to restore free movement to the corridor. Karabakh is internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but is populated mostly by ethnic Armenians. Baku and Yerevan have fought two wars over the region. The latest conflict in 2022 left nearly 300 people dead and displaced more than 7,000. Some sad news from Malaysia, where a light plane has crashed into a residential area, killing at least 10 people. The aircraft was heading to an airport on the outskirts of the capital Kuala Lumpur when it crashed onto an expressway in the central state of Selangor. All 8 passengers on board immediately died. 2 passing motorists on the road were also killed. Civil aviation authorities have not confirmed the casualties yet, but they say that a search and rescue mission is underway. There's a chaotic scene at Germany's Frankfurt airport as intense rainfall turns the runway into a swimming pool. Heavy rain and thunderstorms hit the German city, inundating roads and bringing traffic to a standstill. Video posted on social media showed that large parts of the runway were covered with water. The airport website reported that some 70 flights were canceled due to inclement weather. Thousands of passengers were stranded. On Wednesday, the German Weather Service issued severe weather alerts across the state of Hesse. The death toll from devastating wildfires in the U.S. state of Hawaii rises further as the search operation continues for hundreds more who remain unaccounted for.
So we'll start with where we are in general. 110 individuals
have been confirmed deceased.
This is unprecedented. No one has ever seen this that is alive today. Not this size, not this number, not this volume, and we're not done.
According to Green, rescue and search teams have covered 38% of the fire-ravaged town of Lahaina in Maui County. He said about 2,000 homes and businesses remain without electricity. Blazes forced harrowing escapes and displaced thousands. Officials have been criticized for failing to issue alerts and their lackluster response to the tragedy. Hawaii's Attorney General has already opened an investigation into the authorities' handling of the wildfires. According to the National Fire Protection Association, the Maui wildfires are the deadliest in the U.S. in more than a century, surpassing the 2018 campfire that erupted in California. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. As temperatures soar, Palestinian detainees in the Zionist regime jails live in oven-like prison cells with no available means to cool off. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, the past 5 years of sweltering summers remind Yaqub Abu Asab of the Israeli regime prisons where he spent 15 years of his life. For Palestinian detainees, the hot season is itself a prison within a prison. The Zionist regime's restrictive measures compound the woes of prisoners made to suffer through yearly heat waves in prisons located in the desert or near hot, humid valleys that make life unbearable, the 51-year-old former detainee told Middle East Eye. Abu Asab spent his last sentence of 6 years in Gilboa and Megiddo prisons in northern occupied Palestine, where he says the heat waves get more severe every year. In the Israeli regime prisons, detainees regularly experience shortness of breath and general discomfort due to the absence of cooling systems and small, overcrowded prison cells, which in some prisons hold up to 8 detainees. The Zionist regime's prisons are built with concrete, which retains heat and lack proper ventilation. Meanwhile, some cells have no windows. Some are located underground, while others have single windows overlooking enclosed areas that don't let the breeze circulate. Abu Asab said, inside the cell, the prisoners try to reduce the heat themselves, so they are forced to shower at least 5 times a day in order to protect their bodies from oversweating or from skin diseases. They also spray water on their beds and pillows to produce a little coolness, but that quickly fades away. Prisoners are allowed one small fan in each room, but this only moves the hot air around and doesn't reach the four corners of the room. Prison authorities are also known to cut off electricity from the cells during the day, meaning prisoners cannot even use the fan. Meanwhile, the hot plate used for cooking and heating food makes the cells more stuffy. As a result, some prisoners avoid using it during the summer, eating cold, canned food instead, according to Abu Asab. He said, in our normal situation outside the prison, we can't think, work, sleep, or live in general if we don't have an air conditioner. So you can imagine what being deprived of cooling does to prisoners who are already suffering from harsh conditions and unfair sentences. Bayan Faroun, 28, was detained for 40 months in the Daimon prison located near the coastal city of Haifa and describes the detention facility, which holds 30 female Palestinian prisoners, as an oven. She said, "We shared one fan that was useless, and unfortunately our prison conditions were more difficult than the rest of the prisoners, as the shower was located outside our section and we were only allowed to use it once a day at hours determined by the prison administration. Meanwhile, the only refrigerator for the prisoners was located outside their section and was closed daily from 6 p.m. to 7 a.m., depriving prisoners of access to cold food and drinks." Faroun said, "Because of the intense heat and our need for cold water, we used to bring in the vegetable box and turn it into a small refrigerator by placing water bottles inside, which we had previously frozen, and cool anything we wanted by placing it on top of the bottles. But after a few hours, it becomes warm again." Many female prisoners suffer from bullet wounds sustained during their arrest that sting in the heat. However, Isra Jabis from Al-Quds suffers from deep burns that cover 50% of her body and make the high summer temperatures particularly agonizing. The vehicle she was traveling in exploded just before she was arrested in 2015 for allegedly attempting to carry out an operation against the Zionist regime forces. Faroun said Jabis, with whom she shared a prison section, could sometimes be found crying from pain caused by the effect the heat has on her burnt skin. Jabis also experienced shortness of breath that got worse as the humidity increased in the prison, which, like many others, lacks cooling and ventilation. There are more than 5,000 Palestinians currently incarcerated in Zionist regime prisons. While some of these may be in hotter locations than others, all are exposed to uncomfortable temperatures. Amina Al-Tawil, a researcher at the Palestine Center for Prisoner Studies, told Middle East Eye that the cells holding Palestinian prisoners are closed from all sides with no proper ventilation, while the fans inside the rooms only circulate hot air. The prisoners who suffer most from the heat are detained in prisons located in particularly extreme locations: Naqab, Rimmon, Nafha, and Eshel. in the occupied territories south. These hold nearly half of the total number of Palestinian prisoners. The detainees have described these locations as a piece of hell, where their bodies roast in the intense heat. Tawil said several cases of heat stroke, fainting, and shortness of breath have been recorded this year, adding that the conditions are dangerous for ill prisoners who already don't have access to adequate medical care. She added, instead of helping them, the prison administration sometimes punishes the prisoners by confiscating the fans. Last July, the Naqab Desert saw temperatures reach 50 degrees Celsius, making it impossible for prisoners to go out into the prison yards. Meanwhile, the sweltering heat also brings out poisonous reptiles, insects, and scorpions, which can easily find their way into prison sections, further endangering the lives of prisoners, said Tawil. But as summer ends, Palestinian prisoners are forced to begin preparing for the winter season, which brings with it another challenge, the cold, alongside the continuing pressure applied by the Zionist regime prison authorities, whatever the season. According to Palestine Chronicle, over 600 Palestinian prisoners suffer from different kinds of diseases. 126 of them suffer from chronic diseases, including 26 who have been diagnosed with cancer, according to the Prisoners Affairs Authority. Unfortunately, many cancer-stricken patients have already lost their lives in Israeli regime jails throughout the years. Aside from cancer, the bad living conditions in Israeli regime prisons are conducive to the spread of various diseases. Prisoners only eat canned food. Their cells lack hygiene, and the prisons are overcrowded. In many cases, Palestinian prisoners do not declare that they are sick because of the long procedures to receive treatment and the deliberate policy of medical negligence implemented by Israeli regime authorities. Additionally, the Zionist regime regularly denies prisoners the right to be transported to hospitals or medical institutions under the pretext of overcrowding.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
They say that one time when Imam Hussein alayhi salam was young, there was an incident that took place in Medina where this man had committed some sort of crime and he didn't want to be punished for it. So he runs away and he hides. But eventually he realizes that you can only hide so long after all, and he gets ready to face whatever consequences he's going to. As he comes near to the Prophet to confess and to reveal himself, he sees that near the Prophet are his two grandsons, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein alayhim as-salam. They're just young at that time, so he takes them in his hands and he goes to our Prophet. And he says to Rasulullah, he says that, I've committed the crime, but by the sake of these two, your grandsons, I wish to be forgiven for it. I don't want to face the consequences of it. And when the Prophet sees what he's done, he says that by the shafa'a, by the intercession of these two, you're forgiven for what you've done. Just go ahead. You're not going to be punished for what you did. This is a story, but it gives us a clue. Sometimes we're looking for the wasila, we're looking for that means of success. You can go out about it by yourself, or you can take the path of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. When we come to these gatherings, this is an opportunity for us to reach out and to say that all my deeds on one hand, whatever they are, whatever efforts I put in, I know that all of them don't amount to that much. But what I do know is that if I'm able to connect to Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the Ahlul Bayt, this is what really has value. Our great scholars would say that throughout the year, try to regularly remember Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Because if you do so, that is a way of easing things for you, of making the difficult things easy for you. Sometimes we get stuck in different things and we're looking for a key to unlock them. One of them is these majalis. Brothers and sisters, our topic of the enlightened journey of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is an opportunity for us to learn more about those factors that were present at the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in the culture, in the thinking of the people, that led them to almost, you know, most of the people, they abandoned Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And they allowed the events of Karbala to take place. Over the course of the last number of evenings, we've had the opportunity to learn more about this, to look at different figures from history and see how they faltered and how they represent others who followed their same path. We heard about the stories of Usama bin Zayd and Ahnaf bin Qais, people who took the path of not taking a path, meaning that they supposedly took a path of neutrality, but actually they were just serving their own self-interests. Yesterday we heard about the story of Abdullah ibn Rabi'ah, the famous poet whose words were considered to be like very powerful. People would quote them. They were sung all over the Muslim world. And he represented a type of return to the pre-Islamic era, one where people were obsessed with this culture of celebrity worship at that time. Poets who were known as prophets, words of lust and words of power and anger and revenge. And this is what had occupied the people's minds. If you remember, we talked yesterday about how the entire city comes out to mourn Umar ibn Abdul Rabi'ah's death because they're so attached to his poetry. Tonight, I want to continue this discussion because when we're talking about culture and the culture of Jahiliyyah, whether it be at that time or whether it be at this time, it's super important. Because no matter how much we might say that we're immune to other cultures because we have a strong identity, at the end of the day, we do come across this culture wherever we go, wherever we are. I mean, you're sitting in a shop, you're going through the mall, you hear the music that's being played. You're driving on the motorways. You might see billboards which advertise aspects of this culture of celebrity worship and, you know, music stars and movie stars or whatnot. You can't hide from it. And people take different approaches. And what we see in the long run, when we start to see, okay, what happens when people engage with this culture, we see that the results sometimes are a bit alarming. People's identity can be corrupted when they don't have a proper way of dealing with this culture. So today, inshallah, I want to go into a little bit more detail. And I'd like you to take you back to the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, where, as we talked about, there is this culture that's re-emerging of poetry and of music. But you all know that when you have words which are sung, usually, whatever culture you're in, it doesn't just stop at that. Music and these words of lust and revenge and whatnot, they almost always are also accompanied with a couple of other things. One of them is alcohol. Another one is dancing. And another one is the pursuit of pleasures and shahwat and lusts and desires. And all these typically come together. I mean, you don't need to look too far to see examples of that. Just go, well, actually don't go and look at it, but you can be aware of, like, let's say the music video culture and what that entails. So what we see at the time of Imam Hussein alayhi salam is that through Bani Umayyah, in particular the figure of Yazid ibn Muawiyah, la'anatullahi alayhi, this type of culture of immorality and indecency is something which is being spread. Because when the leader does it, then the followers follow suit. I mean, it's not a wonder, you know how some months back, you might have heard about the news of this big raving concert in the desert sands of Saudi Arabia. It was a big deal. They had brought in, like, you know, the top pop singers, and they did a big concert all through the night. When it came time for Salah, they did stop and they played the Adhan from, like, the big screens. But then as soon as the Adhan ended, they were back to, like, their dancing and music and whatnot. And this was happening not too far from, you know, the holy lands of Makkah and Medina. Why would that happen? I mean, when you look at, you know, the leader and you see, you know, his super yacht and, you know, his other escapades and whatnot, then of course, you know, what happens there, it's going to reflect on the people as well. So this is what's happening at that time. Yazid was somebody who Muawiyah, at one point he realizes he's getting old and he says that after me, I want to put Yazid as the leader. So I got to make some moves from now to put that in place. So he goes, history narrates that he goes to Ziyad ibn Abi, you know, the father of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. He says, give me some advice. You know, I got a problem here. I want to put Yazid, but it seems like people aren't going to really be accepting of that. So Ziyad is almost like laughing at him. He's like, I mean, Yazid, right? He's famous for being the guy who plays with monkeys, right? He's famous for being the guy who spends his time just, you know, playing around with dogs and singing music and composing, like, poetry of lust and whatnot. He's famous for spending time with, like, dancing and singing and instruments and all of that. And you want to make him as the leader, and you have people in the ummah like Abdullah ibn Umar, and, you know, you have the likes of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and you think that people are going to accept it. If you really want to do that, one thing that you can do is tell Yazid to kind of cut back on this, right? Let him at least hide what he's doing, right? He shouldn't be so open about being somebody who's so indecent and so immoral. 1 or 2 years, and, you know, maybe then the people will start accepting his position as the leader. And so what Muawiyah does is, you know, he puts Yazid in charge of the army. They have to go fight a battle. And he's thinking that now Yazid will take on, like, this responsibility. And Yazid, la'anatullahi alayhi, instead, what he does is he spends his time, you know, just fooling around and whatnot. The army gets typhoid, and it's a big issue. They come to him and they say, Yazid, you're our leader. You know, tell us what to do. And instead, he composes poetry saying that, what do I care about typhoid fever when I'm busy enjoying my own lusts and my passions? And he basically tells them, just go and, you know, figure out yourselves.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Hali Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن صلى
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Industrial action and strikes have been waged on a scale not seen in the United Kingdom for decades in the past year, with walkouts hitting the National Health Service, railways, airports, schools, universities, postal services, civil service, and the media industry. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. According to new analysis, nearly 4 million working days in Britain have been lost to industrial action in the past year. It finds that the strikes sparked by soaring inflation and years of stagnating pay are Britain's most intensive since the 1980s. As workers battle with the government and private employers to ease severe real-term wage cuts, the extent to which key sectors have ground to a halt, at times literally, has been further evidenced in a new report by the Resolution Foundation. Published as junior doctors continue a four-day walkout, the think tank finds that sectors including healthcare, education, postal services and railways have been responsible for 96% of all days lost to strike action since 2021. Laying bare the squeeze facing workers, the report found that real terms pay in the 3 months to May was 4.1% lower for all workers than in 2021, with that hit deepening to 9.2% for those in the public sector and to 9.8% in the healthcare and social care. Correspondingly, the report found this appears to have contributed to an increase in job vacancies, with a number of available roles in healthcare, education and public administration 33% higher in March than in December of 2019, and up 23% across the rest of the economy. British newspaper The Telegraph has also covered the same story. Industrial action has been waged on a scale not seen in the United Kingdom for decades in the past year, with walkouts hitting the National Health Service, railways, airports, schools, universities, postal services, civil service, and the media industry, among others. In public sector pay battles, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's insistence that granting workers' demands would further fuel inflation means his government has continued to take a tough line, despite opposition MPs' warning of the strike's impact on an economy already dicing with recession. Ministers have frequently been charged with failing to properly negotiate with unions, while often bizarrely seeking to use the chaos to score political points against the Labour Party, despite Keir Starmer's visibly less than sympathetic stance on the matter. Meanwhile, the government's anti-strike legislation finally passed into law last month, despite severe defeats in the House of Lords. But although ministers have now finally agreed pay settlements with several groups, including nurses and teachers, industrial action is still being waged on several fronts, including by junior doctors and railway workers, with the latter marking the first on a national scale since the 1980s. Nai Cominetti, senior economist at the Resolution Foundation think tank, said, "The recent strikes from teachers and junior doctors reflect the fact that real-term public sector pay has fallen severely in the past few years, as well as the stress and difficult workplace conditions frequently reported by workers in these sectors." Cominetti added, "However, the inflation-driven pay squeeze should also be understood as part of a broader pattern of poor pay growth across both the public and private sectors, and falling pay satisfaction among public sector workers." Nai Cominetti added, "Going forward, the government will need to balance fiscal caution with the need to provide a level of pay for public sector workers that reflects the very real difficulties that they face in these sectors and ensure that vacancies in these sectors continue to be filled." Cominetti added, "In addition, there should also be a renewed focus on improving pay and working conditions for workers in essential sectors like social care that are largely not unionized, but which are still experiencing the effects of job stresses and pay squeezes." British newspaper The Evening Standard has also reported on the same story. The latest data from the Office for National Statistics, ONS, revealed almost 4 million working days have been lost to strike action in the United Kingdom in the past 13 months. Some 3.9 million days were lost through labour disputes from June of 2022 to April of 2023. This is the highest for any period since between July of 1989 to May of 1990, when 4.8 million days were lost. December 2022 saw the most working days lost, with 829,000, the highest total for a single month since November of 2011, when the figures were at 997,000. The data comes as the National Health Service junior doctors walked out for 72 hours as part of the ongoing pursuit of improved pay and working conditions. And teachers in England announced that they would take more industrial action in the coming months. According to analysis by the Press Association news agency, disputes affecting London and North West England together accounted for nearly a third or 30% of all losses in the past 13 months. There were 576,500 days lost in London, or 16% of the total, and 526,100, or 14% of the total, lost in northwest of England. Southeast England saw the next highest number at 466,200 days, or 13% lost, followed by Scotland, 459,500, or 12% of the total lost. Wales recorded the fewest days lost to strike action, 125,500, accounting for just 3% of the UK's total. Teachers in England, represented by the National Education Union, the NEU, are the latest union to announce that they will be walking out after striking in July in a long-running dispute over pay. Major strikes by train operators have also caused complications for the public in recent months, making life difficult in half-term and for those attending specific events such as the Eurovision Song Contest in Liverpool, the FA Cup Final in London, and the Epsom Derby, as their own long-running pay disputes rumble on. The most recent action by the RMT Union and ASLEF on 31st of May and 2nd and 3rd of June came after months of negotiations with the government failed to yield a solution and is unlikely to prove the end of the matter. Of the 3.9 million working days lost to strike action from June 2022 through to July of 2023, more than half, or 57%, or 2.1 million, were in transport, storage and communication industries, a reflection of the frequency of rail strikes, but also of recurring disputes involving Border Force staff and driving instructors. Also, according to a senior healthcare boss, junior doctor strikes have cost the National Health Service about £1 billion, as a fifth round of industrial action threatens further disruption to patient care. Julian Hartley, chief executive of NHS providers, said hospital trusts were having to pay premium rates to consultants to cover the roles of junior doctors whilst they were on the picket lines. He said the walkouts are expected to lead to 1 million procedures and appointments being cancelled and rearranged by the time the round of action is over in 4 days' time.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on June 11, 2023, in a meeting with a number of scientists, specialists, experts, and officials of Iran's nuclear industry. Back then, pro-Western people used to humiliate the nation, and today nation is humiliating people who are pro-Western. Today, our nation is humiliating those individuals who have such thoughts and illusions. How do they humiliate them? With these things that you have constructed and shown us here. This is humiliating people who are pro-Western. This shows the big mistake of those who wanted people to believe that the Iranian nation is incapable. For 20 years, the West has been focusing on our nuclear capabilities. Today, our nuclear facilities and progress, that is our nuclear supplies, are more than 100 times what they were 20 years ago. That is, today we have more than 100 times the nuclear supplies that we had in 2003, which was the beginning of our nuclear challenge with the West, the continuous sanctions, and the like.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Those who are skilled in this field and informed say this. This is the reality of our country. Of course, they did everything they could to stop this movement. They also committed crimes, assassinated people, and took these dear scientists from us by way of their atrocities. They thought that if they took Shahriari, Ali Mohammadi, and the rest from us, the work would stop. Their work didn't stop. It wasn't interrupted. And thank God, it moved forward. That is, our young people and our scientists proved that this industry has been indigenized, that it belongs to the nation, and that it cannot be taken away from this nation. They now confess to this too. I would also like to say something beside the main point here. It is something beside the main point but important. You see, about 500 years have passed since the event that is known in the West as the Renaissance, the change in the path of the lives of the Westerners. During the Renaissance, the most fundamental issue that existed was the confrontation between science and religion. That is, they wanted to say that if you want to progress scientifically, you should put aside religion, spirituality, and the like. This was the most important, or one of the most important lines of the thought of the Westerners movement in the Renaissance. About 500 years have passed since that movement. Today, in the country of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is a country of spirituality and an Islamic republic, the most important scientific work is being done in competition with those who have been working in these scientific fields for so many years. Who is moving the work forward? The faithful youth, people like Fakhrizadeh and Shahriari, who were committed to praying the recommended midnight prayer, they are the ones moving the work forward. That is, science and spirituality are intertwined in this way. This is an important point that must be paid attention to.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.